We will take up where we were left last time in Joshua. We are actually into Judges now. We won't finish that this morning, but I'll do another class for this evening session, and we'll probably finish up Joshua and get close to the start of Judges, and I might just do some extra material to make sure we're brought up to where we need to be. Very quickly, Moses was commissioned by God to lead the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, and he did just that. And we read about that in the books of Exodus through Deuteronomy. The actual departure from the land occurred in the context of Exodus's record. And they went to Mount Sinai. They received the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law. They built the tabernacle according to the pattern that God gave Moses when he was on the mount. That whole system of worship was established. And then the beginning of the second year after they left the land of Egypt, they left Sinai and headed toward the land of Canaan. The opening chapters of Deuteronomy tell us that it was 11 days travel from where they were at that point from Sinai. So they wandered in the wilderness, not because they were lost for 40 years, but because they failed to do what God wanted in Numbers 13. And so Deuteronomy ends with Moses' death. And we saw multiple times in Exodus through Deuteronomy that Joshua was already appointed by God to be Moses' successor. And the beginning of Joshua, the first few chapters, everything that God had promised to and through Moses was going to continue to and through Joshua. Everything that I promised Moses, I'm going to do for you, and so forth. So we see lots of Joshua and Moses' connections. We talked about that in our sermon last time. Moses led them out of the land of Egypt, crossing a body of water. Joshua leads them into the land of Canaan, crossing another body of water, the Jordan River. And lots of points of comparison that we noticed between them. And so during this time, they're actually going to begin the period of conquest. They start with the city of Jericho. And we were talking about that in the context of our last lesson. The spies go into the land and they check it out, and we see that Rahab's introduced in her family. She and others in the city of Jericho had heard what's going on with the children of Israel as they come across the wilderness, as they get onto the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Moabites, where they defeated Og and Sihon. And fear affected those people because they realized that they were coming this direction, that is towards the land of Canaan. And so she by faith, hid the spies, misdirected those who were looking for them. And she received a promise from the spies that when they came and take the land and then conquered the city, that had she let that cord remain outside of the window, that her house would be spared. Remember, the house was built on the side of the wall, and so that's the way they escape. And so we see the preparation made. It was about 3 days before the preparation made for the children of Israel to go into the land of Canaan. The priests go forward, but they get into the water of Jordan, and the water withdraws. They are going to take stones from the Jordan River and erect a memorial on the other side to remind them that God is great and God is mighty and God has delivered them through all of these things. So that takes us through where we were in the opening chapters up to chapter 4. And that chapter talks about the stones that I just alluded to that are going to be taken from the river, and they're going to build a memorial that's going to be noted for the future. Children of Israel, who is this? What are we doing here? How did all this come about? So that's one of the demarcations that's going to be mentioned there. So in chapter 4, if you look in verse 6 and 7, it says that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time and they say, what do these stones mean? And this is what you're going to say. You answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark, that is the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, when it crossed over Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial for the children of Israel forever. And then later in chapter 4, verses 21 and following, especially the last verse says, these are things are done that all the peoples of the earth may know. And that's a very significant theme that we see mentioned throughout Exodus and following, that God did this for Moses, for the elders, for Israel, for Pharaoh, for Egypt, for the world. And so that for the world message is going to be brought out everywhere. All right, chapter 5 is new material. The Amorites had heard what God had done in behalf of Israel. In the opening verses, they were on the west side of the Jordan, and the kings of the Canaanites were by the sea. They heard all the things that God had done, had dried up the Jordan, and allowed them to cross over. And the latter part of verse 1 says, there's no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. So they are marching in that direction towards the land of Canaan, and people heard about that, and they were afraid. The continuation of the covenant of circumcision initiated during the time of Abraham in Genesis 16, 17 and following. They're going to be circumcised as they're coming out of the land of Egypt. They had not been done so. We're not told why. And then so they're going to be circumcised as they go into the land. And notice also that the manna ceases. So God had providentially sustained them with food every day. And then the last part of that chapter is the command of the Lord that meets Joshua. And we see that Joshua falls down before him and worships him, indicating that it's a representative of deity, that is deity itself. The angel of the Lord, often connected with being Jesus himself in his pre-incarnate state in the Old Testament. And we see the points of similarity. We did this in our lesson last Sunday morning in worship, that he was told that the ground where he was holy, just as the angel of the Lord spoke from the burning bush in Exodus 3, saying, this ground is holy, and to remove your sandals. Chapter 6, the actual conquest of the land of Canaan begins with the fall of the city of Jericho. And so they are waiting for them to come, and the means by which they're going to defeat the city of Jericho is spelled out. Verse 3, you're going to march around the city. You're going to do this once a day for 6 days, verse 3. And then the seven priests are going to bear the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark, that is the Ark of the Covenant, is part of the procession. On the seventh day, they're going to go around it seven times. The priest shall blow those trumpets. Then it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall flat, and all the people should go up every man straight before him. So by faith through grace, God's grace is the greater power. By their faith, that is their obedience, they were able to access God's grace. And that's exactly what's spelled out in the book of Hebrews. It says the walls of the city of Jericho fell by faith, but not the moment they believed, the moment they finished all that belief entailed, which means that they were obedient. And so that's the providential way by which the city of Jericho was defeated. So when they did this, we see the rest of this spelled out. So that's what was going to be told. And then the rest of this is spelled out as you go throughout the rest of the chapter. That what was anticipated in the first few verses is going to be fulfilled. So by the time you get to chapter 6, verse 16, the seventh time they blew. So the command and how they're going to do it, earlier part of the verses, now they're actually doing it. And so they blew the trumpet. Joshua tells them to shout. In verse 17, the city shall be doomed by the Lord in destruction. In it and all who are in it, only Rahab and those who are with her, that was part of the promise, are going to be means. Now watch verse 18, and this is key to what we're going to see in the next chapter. Verse 18 of chapter 6, and you by all means keep yourselves from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble. The point is, God had already designated that all of the loot that they were going to gather, that they would have as a result of their victory, was not to be kept. Nobody was to keep it. It was going to go into God's coffers. And so it says, you take all the silver and the gold, the vessels of bronze, and you consecrate them to the Lord. Notice verse 19, they're going to go into the treasury of the Lord. And so there's a bank, if you will. It's a treasury of some kind. It was a real bank with a real vault, as we might think about it. But that money went into the coffers to sustain and support everything that was going to be related to tabernacle worship, the priesthood, and so forth. So that's what they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to keep any of that money. So verse 21 and following, we see the destruction of the city of Jericho spelled out. We see that Rahab and her household are going to be spared in verse 22. The city is going to be burned, verse 24. And again, Rahab spared, verse 25. Joshua spared them because of the message of the spies and charged them again. Notice this, at the end of the chapter, Joshua makes this prophetic prediction. Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds the city of Jericho. He's going to lay its foundation with the death of his firstborn, and the youngest, he's going to set up his gates. And that's going to be fulfilled later in the biblical text when we get into the books of 1 Kings. And so they conquer the city, and there's an admonition, don't take anything from the city. That's all supposed to be dedicated to the Lord. Now that's going to set the stage for the next events that we read in chapter 7. So in chapter 7, we're going to see that somebody did take something, and that's going to be spelled out. And so they go to battle against a smaller city. And so when you read this, he says, don't let all the people go up, verse 3, but let just 2,000 or 3,000 go up and attack Ai. So it's nowhere near as big as Jericho, which God had delivered in their hands. And so they're going to take fewer people, and they go up and they go against the city of Ai, but they're rebuffed and they flee, and some of the children of Israel die. This is just crazy. How can this happen? We defeated Jericho. God was with us. We go against a much, much smaller city and we're defeated. And so Joshua doesn't know what to make of this. Verse 6, Joshua tears his clothes, fell on the earth to his face before the ark of the Lord, and they put dust on their heads, sign of mourning and so forth. And he says, why have you done this, God? Why did you bring us over the Jordan into this land to defeat the Amorites, but only they're destroying us. We would have been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan if we knew that this was going to happen. For the Canaanites, notice verse 9, and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and surround us and cut off our name from the earth. Then what will you do for your great name? And so Joshua was concerned that not only they were defeated, but this is a reflection on God's character, on God's name. And so we find out why they were defeated. So the Lord tells him, let me tell you what's going on. Get up. Don't behave this way. This is what's happened. Israel sinned, verse 11. They've transgressed my covenant. What did they do? Rest of verse 11, they've taken something that I told them not to take. All the stuff that they were going to gather from the city of Jericho was going to go into God's treasury. But that's not what happened. And so they weren't able to stand against the city of Ai because somebody had sinned. And that's going to be spelled out in much more detail as we go further. So he says, get up, sanctify the people, sanctify yourselves. God's going to determine who did this. And so as you read through the chapter, they're going to bring the different people before Joshua by tribes and clans and so forth. And it's going to get to the point that they're going to narrow it down to Achan and his household. So that's what's going to happen starting in verse 16 and following. He brings all the people by tribes, the tribe of Judah, and then he goes through the clans and he brought the different households. And finally, in verse 18, he gets to Achan. And that's the man who was guilty. Joshua says to Achan, let me ask you, what have you done? Verse 19, I beg you, give glory to the Lord God of Israel, make confession to him, and tell me now what you have done. Don't hide it from me. And so, you know, Achan's going to fess up. Achan answers and says, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and this is what I've done. All right, two things before we go forward. Confession of sin has to be understood as first and foremost as something against God and God's nature. All right, the man that we refer to as the prodigal son took advantage of his dad, took advantage of his brother, took advantage of lots of people, and took all the money and blew it away in riotous living. And when he came to himself, he said, I've sinned against my father and my God. All right, so he realized it was a sin against God. So in this context, Achan doesn't say, I've sinned against you, Joshua. I've sinned against the nation, both of which were true, and I've sinned against myself and against my family. But he realized this first and foremost, this was a sin against God. And that's a major admission that has to be accepted, is that sin is primarily against God. And then he says, here's what I've done. Now, the second point I wanted to mention is this. I saw among the spoils a beautiful Babylonian garment, 200 shekels of silver, and a wedge of silver weighing 50 shekels, a wedge of gold, excuse me, weighing 50 shekels. I coveted them and took them, and there they are, hidden in the earth in the midst of my tent with the silver under it. If you look at Bible background commentaries, it will tell you that the approximate worth of the stuff that he stole was enough to sustain a person for a lifetime. and to exceed. But that's kind of, that you could see where that would be an allure, that would be a temptation. And so if the average person made $50,000 a year over 40 years, that's $2 million. So imagine all of a sudden you see something worth roughly that in today's money and think, man, I won't have to work another day as long as I live. You know, who's gonna know? Nobody's gonna know. He saw it, he took it, nobody else knew about it, but God knew. And so the attraction was incredibly strong, but still it was supposed to be devoted to God. So they went to the tent, they found it and so forth, and Achan and his family are going to be punished as a result of that. They're going to be destroyed. And so Joshua says, why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you. And their stone, they raised up him over a great a heap of stones. And that's the end of chapter 7. So now they're going to go back against the city of Ai in chapter 8. And this time they're going to be victorious. They were defeated the first time. Because against Ai, because they had stolen during the city of Jericho. And so the number of times that God tells people to do something, he says, go up and take the land of Canaan now. And they said, we're not going to do it. He says, okay, you're going to be punished for 40 years, wander in the wilderness for the duration of 40 years. They said, oh, now we're ready to do it. And so the lesson there is, you're not only supposed to do what God says, you're supposed to do it when God says to do it. And now in this message, we see they go up against the city of Ai. They're supposed to defeat it, only they had broken a promise Achan had done before, don't take anything. So they did something else, a violation of God's will, and they suffer the consequences. If you change what God says, you don't do what God says, go beyond what God says, there are consequences. Do what God says when God says to do it, if there's a time stamp connected with that. Don't do what God says in the context of the city of Jericho taking those goods, or there's going to be a consequence later. So Achan's decision cost other people's lives. You know, and that's an unfortunate thing. You know, people can do something that they shouldn't be doing today and can cost somebody else's life. You know, somebody says, you know, they're gonna go get drunk and they're gonna get in a car and drive down the road. They may lose their own life, but it may also cause other people to lose lives. So now, chapter 8. They defeat the city of Ai. That's going to be spelled out. And the mechanics, that is the tactics that they employ to get the people to come out and so forth. So they took 5,000 men, and you see how they arrange them on one side and another side. And they are going to lure the people. The king of Ai saw it, saw the men hasten and rose early and went out against them and said, we defeated them once, they're retreating. Only they didn't realize it was an ambush, verse 14. And so they were able to defeat them. And so that's an interesting thing. I had a student years ago who was a big Civil War history buff, and he wrote a paper in the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth on all the military victories. And what he studied was the tactics that they employed. He says, you know, I would have never thought to study Bible from the standpoint of military tactics, but you see it multiple times in this and other texts. So that was one instance of that. All right, the last few verses of the chapter contain an account of what Moses commanded the people when they came into the land of Canaan, which is similar to what we saw in the closing chapters of the book of Deuteronomy. So they capture the city of Ai. The details of that are spelled out in the first 29 verses. And then verse 30 and following, they built an altar to the Lord God of Israel, Mount Ebal, as Moses the servant of the Lord had commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones over which no man has wielded any iron tool. That's verse 31. And they offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And there in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. So this is a redo, so to speak. It's a recommitment of the law. So Moses writes on tablets of stone the second time. God did it the first time, and now Joshua's going to do the same thing. And so they do this to recommit themselves to be faithful to the law that was given by God through Moses at Sinai. There in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Then all Israel, with their elders, officers, judges, stood on either side, the priests, the Levites who bore the ark, everybody that was gathered there, they were half of them in front of Mount Gerizim, half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses the servant of the Lord had commanded before, that they should bless the people. And afterward, he, that's Joshua, read all the words of the law, verse 34. the blessings and the cursings according to all that is written in the book of the law. There's not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the congregation of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them. And so there's a huge component, as we were in the book of Joshua at the very beginning. Everything that God said through Moses, I'm going to do. I'm going to continue doing these things through you. And so he's not Moses giving another law. He's not Moses at all, but he does the same thing that Moses did. He repeats the law, as we see in Deuteronomy. It's read again in the presence of the children of Israel after the defeat of the city of Ai. Something else that's interesting to note in verse 35, it talks about all the people that were present. Everybody is there. Their designations are mentioned earlier, the priests, the judges, the officers, and the elders, and so forth. And in verse 35, it makes reference to the congregation. The women are there, the children, the little ones are there, and it says, and the strangers who are living there among them. I don't want to draw too much attention to this, but if you go back to the book of Exodus and you look in the context of the law as it was given in Exodus chapter 20, excuse me, in Exodus chapter 12 when they left. See if I can put my finger on the verse without looking too long. In Exodus chapter 12, starting in verse 31, Moses and Aaron are called in the middle of the night by Pharaoh and says, all right, get up, go, you know, take everything, get out of here. You know, the death of the firstborn has just transpired. And so they're going to prepare to leave, and they're going to leave with everything in haste. They take their kneading bowls, they take all their clothes, put them on their shoulders, and they begin to leave right away. The Egyptians had given them all sorts of things. In the middle of the night, the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and they left. And then it says, the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot. The number is given in more detail than Numbers, besides the children. And then it says, a mixed multitude went up with them also. The point is, when Israel left the land of Egypt, there are lots of other people who are strangers in the land and may have been enslaved in the land that fled when they did. And so in this context, as he's repeating the law, he talks about the strangers who were living among them. And so Israel left, but Israel didn't just leave by themselves. There were lots of other hangers-on, if you will, mixed multitude or strangers in this context that left with them. All right, chapter 9 is very interesting. Chapter 9 talks about the Gibeonites. And who were the Gibeonites? Well, they're spelled out in this chapter. They are in the area of the land, all right? So it talks about the different inhabitants of the land in verse 1, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, and so forth. So these people gathered together to fight with Joshua. And so the Gibeonites heard about this, the inhabitants of Gibeon heard about it, what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai. They said, we don't want to fight. You know, we're not going to be part of this alliance of people that's going to fight. We're going to do something else. So verse 4 tells us they worked craftily. What did they do? They pretended to be ambassadors. They took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. All right? So they're going to pretend. What are they going to pretend? Well, watch. They go to Joshua, to the camp of Gilgal. They said to them, we've come from a far country. There's the pretense. They weren't from a far country. All right? Now, therefore, make a covenant with us. But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, perhaps you dwell among us, so how can we make a covenant with you? And they said to Joshua, well, where are your servants? And Joshua said, who are you? Where do you come from? They said to him, notice again, from a very far country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt. Well, it's true that they heard about what God did in Egypt. It's also true that they heard what he'd done to Jericho and Ai. And so ostensibly they came to be servants of God. Only they weren't from a far place. And we heard about all he did to the two kings of the Amorites, that's Og and Sihon, on the other side of the river beyond the Jordan. All right, and he mentions their names there. Therefore, our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said, let's take provisions, let's go on this journey, let's go meet them and say, we're going to be your servants. All right, we are going to be your servants. Make a covenant with us. The bread that we took when we left, it's all dried out and moldy. All right, but they did that again on purpose. And the wineskins that we left, they were filled with new wine, and now they're old and they're torn. Notice when we left, you know, we left with good stuff, and now our garments and our sandals have become old because of this very long journey. Of course, the whole thing is this was staged. Then the men of Israel took some of the provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. Big issue there. Right? They didn't ask of God what they should do. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the rulers of the congregation swore to them. So the people lied on a large scale. They did so for a good reason from their perspective. They didn't want to be defeated. They didn't want to be killed. So they pretended to be from a great distance. They pretended to come and say, we're here to worship your God. We're going to honor his great name, and we're going to become your servants. That's true. They wanted to become the servants rather than be killed. But how true they were to wanting to worship God is questionable based upon the other things. And it says, it happened at the end of 3 days. At the end of 3 days after they made a covenant, that they heard that they were neighbors who dwelt near them. So they found out after they'd already made a commitment, you're not from a far country. You didn't come from a great distance with, you know, and all your stuff wore out before you got here and all the food turned bad. You're right from us. So the children of Israel journeyed, came to their cities on the third day. The cities were, and they list them. Children of Israel did not attack them because the rulers of the congregation had sworn with an oath, and the congregation murmured against the rulers. How did you let yourselves be duped? All right, you got conned. All right, I remember the lady's name. Anybody ever watch Shark Tank? All right, Shark Tank. It's a bunch of rich people who you present, and I don't mean that in a negative way. Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and other people are very well known in the business world. People come before them and they pitch something about a business thing, and they want one of these guys or more of them, and the ladies as well, to invest in that. And so Barbara Corcoran is one of the ladies that's often on there, and she's a real estate multimillionaire. I understand that she has staked Mark Spain, the big guy in Atlanta, multiple millions of dollars to help him in his real estate business. Well, a week or two ago, somebody fleeced her out of almost $400,000. Somebody sent a message to her bookkeeper saying, you owe X amount of dollars for a real estate project that we've done. It was like $380,000, almost $400,000. And the person routinely sent it ahead to the bookkeeper and wrote a check and sent it. And they found out later that the name of the person was misspelled. And so when they got a receipt saying, thank you for your payment, they didn't know what was going on. And I'm thinking, that's pretty weaselly. So somebody stole almost $400,000 from her. She was really upset at first, probably never get it back. She said, it's only money. But the point was, she was con. Somebody pretended to be somebody they weren't, pretended to be a real bookkeeper, and sent it on to, you know, a place for payment, and they just routinely wrote a check. Let me just tell you, if somebody sends me a bill for $400,000, it ain't going to be paid, all right? I'm just saying. All right, but my point was, they pretended to be something they were not. They pretended to be something that they were not. So when they were caught, the children of Israel had already made an oath. We're going to protect you. We're going to be with you. We're going to help you. And so they weren't very happy. So the ruler said in verse 19, we've sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel, therefore we may not touch them, but this is what we're going to do. You lied to us, all right? We will let them live, verse 20, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore to him. And the ruler said to them, let them live, but now you're going to have to work for us. You're going to be woodcutters, you're going to be water carriers and so forth. And so they didn't make them slaves, but in effect they said, you're going to have to serve us. You lied to us. Now, what's interesting is this promise that was made here is going to be brought up again during the times of King Saul and King David. King Saul is going to break the promise against the Gibeonites, and King David's going to make it right again. So the promise that they made hundreds of years later to protect these people still stands. So you don't break covenant, right? So Joshua called for them, says, you've deceived us. You said we're far from you, but that's not true. Verse 22, you're cursed. None of you shall be freed from being slaves, woodcutters, and so forth. So they answered Joshua and said, it was certainly told to your servants, us, that the Lord your God commanded his servants Moses to give you all the land to destroy the people. We knew about that. We are very much afraid for our own lives. Verse 24, and now we're in your hands. Do whatever you want to us. All right? So he did. He delivers them to the hand of the children of Israel. but they didn't kill them, but they became their servants, as we see in verse 27. So that's an interesting discussion. I sum it up in only three lines in the outline, but if you read through the chapter as a whole, it's an incredible story about what God had done to ensure that they didn't violate a promise, even one made without all the proper information. All right, so they promised to sustain them and to protect them, and that's going to happen, continue going further. All right, chapter 10 is another interesting discussion. I only sum it up in a few lines here. And so they're going to be attacked, and let's just read the opening verses. It came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard about Joshua had taken Ai and utterly destroyed it, as he had done so to Jericho, as he'd done to Ai and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon made peace with Israel and were among them. So notice, he heard about Jericho, he heard about Ai, and he also heard about Gibeonites were going to be protected by the children of Israel. That they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities. This is the people who came and submitted to them. And because it was greater than Ai and all its men were mighty, therefore Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent a Hehan king. Now notice all these kings. He's going to send a message to them, verse 3. He says, come to me and watch. You come and help us to attack Gibeon. Just a reminder, Gibeonites were the people who just lied and acted as if they were from a far country. And Joshua says, we will protect you. So he says, Gibeon's a pretty big city. Let's go and conquer Gibeon. That's what Adonizedek says he's going to do. Therefore, the five kings and the Amorites, and mentions their name, Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and the king of Eglon, they gather together and they're going to go against Gibeon. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp of Gilgal, said, don't forsake your servants, come to help us. So Joshua ascended from Gilgal and all the people and so forth. And the Lord said to Joshua, don't fear them. So notice, not only are they going to protect them from the standpoint of letting them be their servants and not killing them, but when these other enemies attack them, they're going to go and defend them. So Gibeon's got a great deal going here, and I'm not at all excusing their deception at the beginning. So Joshua's going to protect their city. So Joshua, therefore, came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal, and the Lord routed them. And so they defended the people of Gibeon. So they honored the commitment, so we're not going to break the commitment, and when they're attacked by all these five kings, they're going to go against them. And so the Lord's going to sustain them miraculously, as we read, and providentially in verse 11 and following. And as they're involved in the battle, the day is prolonged, another miracle of God in their behalf. So the sun stands still over Gibeon as they're able to defeat them. And there's never a day that had been like that before that the Lord fought for Israel. And so the kings who came against the Gibeonites are going to be not only defeated, but they're going to be killed. And the rest of that is spelled out in verses 16 and following. Then in verses 28 and following through the end of the chapter, more of about the period of conquest and the different lands that they conquered in the southern part of the nation. And all those kings and their cities are spelled out and in great detail. So we're going to see that the period of conquest is proceeding. Chapter 11, it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, he sent to Jobab, king of Madon. So notice there's going to be another conglomeration, you know, of kings that's going to fight against them. They were from the north, and they're going to gather together. And they went out, and all their armies, as many as the peoples, the sand, verse 4, and all these kings met together, and they're going to fight against Israel. So the first group of kings are going to fight against Gibeon. Because Gibeon's a big city, Joshua and the children of Israel come to their defense. Now in the north, another conglomeration of kings are going to fight against Israel, and they're going to be defeated as well. So more nations, south, north, in the middle, all over the place, are going to be defeated. Notice again what God says to Joshua in verse 6, don't be afraid of them. This time tomorrow, you're going to be able to deliver against them, to vanquish them. Verse 8, that's exactly what we see happen, and God's going to, through Joshua, defeat the children of Israel. So all of those kings and so forth that came against them in the two different chapters that we just looked at, Joshua defeated. And he did so fulfilling the commandments that God had given to Moses in verse 12. If you look through the chapter, we're not going to look at it now, but if you look at the expression, as the Lord commanded Moses, or something like that, that's going to pop up all over the place in Joshua, indicating that God continued to do what God continued to do through Joshua what he had initially commanded Moses. So we see it in verse 12. We see it again in verse 15, as the Lord had commanded Moses. So Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua didn't leave anything undone. So that principle is everywhere. So a summary of some of the conquest, the latter part of chapter 11, starting in verse 16. Joshua took all this land, the mountain country and the south, the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands. So it just gives a quick overview of all the places that he defeats. He makes war against all of these kings for a long time. No city after that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. That's the ones that we mentioned before. So it was of the Lord to harden all the hearts of these people, and they fight against Israel, and Israel's going to defeat them. All right, that takes us through the end of the 11th chapter, and we're going to see more conquest spelled out in chapter 12. But we're just about out of time. We're going to kind of keep that. But more kings are going to be mentioned in this. We'll just mention chapter 12 because it's a quick summary. These are the kings of the land whom the children of Israel defeated. So it's Sihon, that's on the other side of the Jordan, and Og, verse 4, on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon in verse 2. And then that's the ones that were defeated when Moses was still leader. That was before they came to the land of Canaan and ready to cross over. And then the kings that Joshua conquers, starting in verse 7, and all those are listed. So it's going to list the king of Jericho, the king of Jerusalem, verses 9, the king, verse 10, Jerusalem, the king of Jarmuth, 1, the king of Eglon. So all those kings are listed, and there's a total of 31 kings that are defeated there. And then chapter 13, we'll take up with that in our session for this evening. It talks about the remaining land that's going to be conquered. And by this time, I will do the class for this evening and post it. I'm sorry. Thank you. Not meeting this evening, but I will still post it later today that we would do in as if we were meeting. So thanks for the reminder. All right. Just notice verse 1 of chapter 13, and then we'll stop. Joshua, by this point, so we've gone through 12 chapters, and there's 12 more chapters in the book, so we're only halfway through the text. But Joshua is already an old man by the time we get midway through the text. Joshua was an old man, and the Lord said to him, "You're old, advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed." This is the land that yet remains, and he's going to spell out where it is, starting with the Philistines, the Geshurites, and so forth. And so halfway through the book of Joshua, there's a lot of stuff that's been done, but there's a lot more that remains. And so we're going to talk about how that's going to be fulfilled as the text continues. So we'll stop, take a break, and we'll do the rest of that material presented in our session that would have been done this evening.